You're listening to Awaken with Angus Ford Robertson. Exploring humanity's greatest mystery, awakening through awareness. Hello, greetings and welcome. Angus here, season 2, episode 2. And I want to start with a quick thank you to you guys that got in touch after the first episode, the first installment last week with Pete Russell, interviewing Pete on his take on what is ego, what is consciousness, and plenty of other light and fluffy stuff. But some really wonderful comments coming in, and I'm delighted that it was triggering and prompting all sorts of debate and conversation. Now, this week, I'm happy to report that we tackle a couple of really key questions that keep coming up, certainly on my courses and my retreats. They've come up for years, and I think it's something that, well, I'm just thrilled that I got to address it with Pete and to get his take on it. The subjects that are coming up this week in this episode are around formal versus informal meditation. And for those of you that don't know what that means, don't worry, we explain. So we go into that, but it's quite a tricky subject for people when they're new to spiritual inquiry and they're new to awakening and what that means. How much of the practice is formally on the mat versus how much of it is living it day to day, moment to moment? So we look at that. We also go into another really hot and sometimes rather contentious topic of spiritual bypassing. I won't say any more for now. Listen up. It's a great conversation, and I look forward to your comments as and when. I have been excited all week, genuinely, to pick up where we left off last time, because I found myself with more questions than answers at the end of it. But that's normally the case when I'm speaking to you, and I love that about our relationship and our friendship. I want to start with one question today. It's something that for certainly my students, I suppose if I'm really honest, I sometimes get wrong-footed on this. The headline is this: formal meditation versus informal meditation. Formal practice versus informal practice. Mm-hmm. Now, to sort of start this conversation off before we get all your thoughts and ideas on it, there seems to me that generally speaking, there's two camps in this world. There's certain folk, and certainly many teachers, who are, you got to get the discipline and do the formal sitting, and you need to be sitting at this time of morning and this time in the evening, and da 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 da. And then you have the other camp. It's like, what are you talking about? It has to be something that becomes your every living day, moment by moment practice, and it's informal. It's not a sort of, I do it from 9 till 10 in the morning and da da da. So you can see where I'm headed with this. And sometimes I have to say, I feel on a little bit of shaky ground because my practice has changed. When I started, I was certainly very much from the Theravadan Buddhist school of thought that you have sittings and they are timed and practiced and done in a certain way. 22 years later, and the rest maybe, that's changed. That's really changed. It's become a much softer, gentler, informal, doing my best to live it moment by moment. And, you know, when you get the question from the student, so when should I be sitting and how often? I find myself sometimes a little like, huh, how long have you got? This is a tricky one. So does that explain where I'm headed with this before I...
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
The floor is yours, Pete. I want to hear all your thoughts on this. Where do we land?
Okay, where I am at the moment is both. Mm. Or rather, probably a softer formal and the informal. But I really like both and do both. when I say a softer formal, I don't suggest people have a fixed meditation point of time or fixed meditation period. You know, I usually suggest whatever suits you. I say, you know, 20 to 30 minutes is probably good, not much less than 15 for regular practice because you need time to settle in. But it's during the formal practice that we get to really practice the techniques. We get to practice the letting go, the not following the thoughts, the being attentive to whatever it is in mindfulness, to our breath, to our body, to our feelings. So that's practice. It's like, you know, when you, if you're learning tennis, you know, you have periods where you, you know, you practice and practice and practice, and then you go out on the court and do it.
Mm.
And so for me, the formal, or rather soft formal, is just that it's a time to really be deliberately become aware of what is happening, how your mind is working, how you get distracted, how you can come back to the present moment. Mm. And then that is a training to take out into life. And so I encourage what I call micro meditations, or mini and micro meditations. I actually have a subtle difference there. For me, a mini meditation is, you know, you've got a couple of minutes, just sit down, pause, slow down, you know, relax, let your breathing relax, and just come back into the moment for a while. And do that when you have the opportunity. And then there's what I call micro meditations, which is at any time, usually between tasks, is just a pause. I say between tasks, it's like you're changing tasks, like I'm moving from talking to you to going and making a cup of tea. So in that, I've already paused what I'm doing, but then to just pause my thinking, just to say, okay, wherever my mind is, it's probably on the next thing I've got to do or something I said to you that I wish I hadn't said that way or whatever it is. My mind is off on something. So then pause the thinking and just notice, as soon as I pause the thinking, there's that sense of ease, that sense of a little relief from the tension that's going into thinking. And the present moment reemerges. I don't have to do anything to be present. It's like when I pause the thinking, it's like, yes, I notice. Well, there's the sound of the bird or whatever, or that itch in my knees. The present reemerges. And 10 seconds later, I'm off on another thought, okay, or whatever, or I'm doing what I'm doing. But that way, it's really nice because it reinforces the value of doing it. It's like, yes, I feel better. I'm back in the present moment. So that's my take, is both and the two support each other. But if I weren't doing my more formal practice, I wouldn't be having the training to take out to do the informal.
Mm.
And for me, the formal practice is usually when I begin the day, you know, when I start the day, it's part of my day. And sometimes the end of the day, you know, I like to fit it in then as well.
Mm.
But yeah, one thing I suggest to students is actually to have some form of regularity, you know, to have a time that works for you to sit down on your cushion, chair, bed, wherever it is you like to meditate. Because that establishes it as part of your daily living. And if you don't have time, some days you're about to rush out the door, but to still go and just sit down for a couple of minutes, take a few deeper breaths, so you get into that habit, there's always some period of a more formal meditation.
Mm.
But I'm very flexible about how long it should be. It's what suits you, what works for you.
Yes. Yes, that's lovely, beautifully put. And I do, I certainly resonate with everything you're saying there, Pete, about the mix of both. There is another contentious point that I'm going to question you on in a moment.
I'm sure you will.
there is something that I want to quiz, which we'll come to in one moment. But just to name this, I think your point around rhythm and getting a routine is certainly something that I've put in my online courses. And I know you're definitely a fan of this and your courses, online courses and so on. supporting and encouraging students to find that rhythm, because we are creatures of habit. We like to follow a pattern. I remember distinct periods of my time where actually having that formal time, formal sounds too formal, but that set aside time to sit down in the evening, it felt so nurturing and just like, oh gosh, yes. Oh, I can cope again. You know, so it was very reassuring and nurturing and self-compassionate to find that rhythm that you're talking about. So I fully resonate with what you're saying. The thing that I want to question and probe a little more is effort versus effortlessness. Now, I know that with your practice, and you know I've been a fan and following your work for, well, since as long as we've known each other, which I think is about 20 years now, is it? Is it 15 years, 20 years, something like that?
20, at least 20.
Yeah, I think it is 20. Since that time, I've been very aware of this, increasingly emerging theme of the effortlessness that you, Pete, are teaching and endorsing. Now, I just want to counterbalance that with a lot of the Buddhist work that I've been exploring recently, and one teacher in particular, Ayakema, I never know if I'm pronouncing that right, Ayakema, but she's... a wonderful teacher that you... Do you know her? Are you familiar with...
No, I'm not.
Yeah, she's written some rather wonderful books that... Being Nobody, Going Nowhere. She's a sort of... I suppose she's a forerunner of Pema Chodron. And one of the points she gets across, rather forcefully in my view, is this takes effort. This takes determination and will. You will need to push through all the resistance, which of course on one level is true. And I'm also aware that your point of the effortlessness of dropping into silence and stillness is also true. So I think it's useful to speak about this, because there's quite a seeming paradox for a lot of students. This, hold on, am I meant to be grafting and making effort and driving forwards with this? Or is it all meant to be easy and effortless? So do you see where I'm headed with this?
Oh, I see where you're going, definitely.
I'm going to shut up. Go on, tell me what your take is on that. Is there anything for you that's coming up on that issue?
Yes. Firstly, what do we mean by effort here? Mm. I mean, what I mean by effortless is not trying to reach a certain state, not trying to control the mind, not straining, not focusing the attention on something. You know, there are practices which do that. I acknowledge that. It does need discipline, but I would say a gentle discipline. We just talked about, you know, the discipline of sitting down at a regular time. That's a discipline. And you know, it's a very soft discipline, as we've been saying. And then there's intention. Intention is really important. It's not just sitting down and going, isn't this nice, lovely, I'm so relaxed. Yes, that's part of it. But the intention is to... is an inquiry for me. There's an intention that, I mean, in my practice specifically, it's like, okay, the intention is to, first of all, whenever there are thoughts, choosing not to follow those thoughts, just choosing to say, okay, another time. So there's that intention, and the intention to notice how it is as the mind begins to settle down, to notice that quality of beingness that's there, to notice any, you know, the quality of stillness that might come. So there's that intention to actually be aware of what is happening in the practice as the mind settles down. So intention is definitely part of that. Now, there are many practices which, you know, encourage you to, you know, really work hard. And I sometimes think there's a sort of unfortunate vicious circle here, because my experience is, and this is my experience of teaching people, not just my own experience, in just one sitting, when people get the idea of allowing the mind to relax, allowing the attention to relax, and just being with things as they are without putting any effort or trying or goals into it, people will drop into a very quiet, enjoyable state immediately. I'm not immediately, but in that first session. It doesn't take years and years of practice to get there.
No, I was just going to say, I think you've already nailed it. It's what she's talking about, and you've alluded to this, is that, of course, when we are perhaps in the early stages of our practice and the mind is chaotic and distracted and restless, oh boy, it's going to take some discipline and a little bit of intention and grit to get your ass to sit on that goddamn cushion and stay there, because that's the last thing the mind wants to do when it's agitated. But as you also named, the paradox is that once we get the essence and the feeling of settling, then the more effortlessness we can bring into it, the better, the more efficient, the more sublime it might be. So there is a real paradox. It's not that becoming a world-class enlightened meditator is easy in that sense, because it takes discipline and focus and a little bit of intention and going against the narrative of social structures that we should all be out in the pub and playing bingo and doing this, that, the other. We have to go against that. That takes effort. Mm-hmm. And then when we're in it, then it's effortlessness that we're looking for.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yes. I would actually not use the word effort in the first case. I would use discipline,
right,
intention. It's the discipline to say, okay, I'm not going to the pub tonight because, you know, and I value meditation, and it's the intention to come and sit down some stage every day. I wouldn't say that takes effort. For me, effort is the trying, it's the gritting, it's the focusing of intention. Mm-hmm. And for me, meditation, the key thing is letting the attention relax rather than focusing. And I talk about letting the attention zoom out rather than zooming in. Most of the time, our attention is zoomed in, focused on something. And for me, meditation is the opposite. Like, it's zoomed out. It's a softer, more expansive awareness. You know, I'd say that there are many techniques which work on the zooming in, you know, really do this and, you know, see if you maintain awareness of your breath for 10 breaths, you know, whatever
Vipassana,
it is.
Meditating on the tip of your nose for 12 days, you know. Yeah. No, I love that. And I always teach that last aspect that you're talking about in terms of spotlight versus floodlight. Awareness,
exactly.
Is that pulling back, that softening of awareness, all-encompassing, rather than honing in and focusing on one thing. Yeah. Yes, no, that's beautifully put, Pete. This leads nicely into something that I know you're a fan of, which is just give, and you do very well, I might say, giving little tidbits and meditation tips. And I don't want to labor this right now, but it would be lovely while we're on this sort of direction of formal versus informal practice. Could you give one or two little tips that you're in favor of these days for reminding students how to drop into
yes. I think the first one would be start gently. You know, don't say, okay, I'm going to sit down, close my eyes, okay, where's my breath?
Yes.
You know, I always encourage people, first of all, you know, close your eyes, or even before you close your eyes, just take a few deeper breaths, breathing out like, that's a sign to the body that things are okay, there's no threats, I can relax. So just taking a few deeper breaths, allowing the body to relax, and then, even then, not rushing into it, just sitting gently and just becoming aware of, here I am, here's the sounds around, here's my body awareness, here's what I'm noticing. So you just gradually, I would say take a minute or two to just slowly ease into it, and then whatever practice you're doing, that will come much, much easier, and again, more effortlessly. And also at the end of meditation, people tend to rush out. It's like, okay, the timer goes off or whatever. I don't recommend using a timer. I much prefer you use your own intuition, and if you're 2 minutes late or 2 minutes early, who cares?
Ah, interesting.
I don't need a time.
That. Ah, good.
And okay. if you really, you know, or if you want to, again, I don't really recommend it, but have your, you know, a clock or your phone nearby and you can peek out one eye and say, oh, okay, another 3 minutes or whatever. Don't use a timer because that'll jar you. So when you feel it's time to finish, just sit there, you know, complete the practice, and then just begin to bring your attention out into the world. Like I suggest, you know, moving your fingers, flexing your fingers or toes a little bit. And even then, not open the eyes immediately, but when you do, just a little bit to begin with, let a little light in, and then let, you know, then fully open them and just be there. And even then, just sit for a few moments, just like, ah, you know, just savoring how it was. That way, you will bring more of the quality of the meditation into your life than if you simply, a bell goes off and you jump up and get on with things. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I like that. That's nice. I'm embarrassed to say, Pete, that I was not only the person that would jump up at the end and... in the early days, I would go to a yoga class, and when the teacher would say, right, and now we've got final 10 minutes in Savasana, I would make excuses and leave. Can you believe it? I'm so embarrassed to own that, but that is the truth. The first few classes I went to, I would leave because I just thought that Savasana and digesting the experience was utterly pointless. Pete, I had things to do. So I get it, and you're really reminding everyone to just enjoy the stillness at the end.
Yes.
I often wish at the end of my classes in Bhasta Yoga that I could let people stay for half an hour. Often that time doesn't allow, but it's the most divine little moment, isn't it? The 10 minutes at the end of the class, or the pranayama, or the yoga practice, whatever it is, just... nothing needs to happen.
Yeah.
Absolutely divine.
Yeah.
Lovely. Now, before I let you go, there is one other issue which is on my my long list of things I want to chew over with you. And it's a phrase that a little bit, I suppose, is not... not used as much. A few years ago, so let me ask you, a few years ago, were you aware of the phrase spiritual bypassing being bandied about willingly?
Oh, yes, right. For many years. I would say 10, 15 years.
It's been. Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. So you were ahead of the curve. So before I give my little pennyworth on this, what does that phrase mean to you, and what does it bring up for you?
Okay, it's not something I've, you know, explored in any great depth. So what it means to me is a fairly, you know, surface interpretation of it. And you might, you know, go a lot deeper into it. What it means to me is people thinking, because I've, you know, I'm meditating well, I am, you know, noticing the quietness, I'm feeling better, I am more aware of myself and stuff, that I'm doing fine. I'm on a great path. I found my way to becoming a better person. And the bypassing that I see in that is bypassing the need to do more deeper psychological work. I mean, we all have so much, quote, stuff, unquote, you know, there from childhood, from our conditioning, from our society, so much stuff which is leading us into making judgments about people, getting angry, into wanting things, whatever it is. There's a whole area of inner work that needs to be done in parallel with the spiritual work. And in a way, it is spiritual. It doesn't come under that name, spiritual. The spiritual is the more the going within. Here I am, my own sense of deeper self, whatever. This is in parallel. And I think it's actually a really critical part, because it actually, in the end, serves the meditation as well. Because, you know, the question is, why do I have thoughts in meditation? You know, I'm sitting there very quietly, all is peaceful, and suddenly I'm off on what a stupid thing that person said yesterday. Or I really need to say this to someone, whatever it is. That's coming from our stuff. It's all in there, bubbling away, fermenting, and then, you know, when it sees an opportunity, it comes up to, you know, tell you what to do or complain or whatever. And So I think the more we can actually deal with that or become more aware of it, it's going to be over time less of an interruption to the meditation, because it's less of an interruption to our life generally. Mm. So that's my take on it. You know, maybe other people have gone a lot, you know, see a lot more to it. That's just how I.
Well, I'm going to share my view on it, and then maybe that might. Who knows? That might trigger some other reflections. I suspect it will, but for me. This is where I discover, of course, my therapeutic training very much comes to the fore. In the therapeutic world, certainly a few years ago, and perhaps to some degree now, people use the phrase spiritual, you're spiritual bypassing, you're a bypasser. They use it as a cosh to beat people over the head. Now, in situations where that person, that's being called a spiritual bypasser, in situations where, as you say, they're just not owning their shit and they're in denial or avoidance mode, mm-hmm. Absolutely right. The phrase is absolutely useful and probably very legitimate as an observation. They've spiritually bypassed. They've checked out of the embodied reality of irritation, jealousy, whatever the mood is, and they've almost dissociated. They've just gone vertically, as I call it, up into spirit world. Nothing bothers me. Spiritual bypassing. And I'm fully in agreement with you. Not helpful. However, there is another side to it which really does rile me, actually. It gets me pretty heated when it's used by the name caller as a justification for staying in their egoic, could be anger, rage, self-righteousness, and so on. So what I noticed in the therapeutic world was that a lot of very, very angry people would sometimes call out so-called spiritual bypassers, when in fact, in my view, it was completely in reverse. The name caller was had thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And what I mean by that is the other party, in some cases, was legitimately seeing that their mind-made creation of and construct of the world was just their mind. It wasn't real, and they had settled back into being. They had seen that this situation had arisen. Maybe they'd behaved poorly. Maybe something had happened. But then they had seen it, and with their floodlight awareness, they drop the story and drop back into being and presence. Meanwhile, there's a person on the other side of the room going, spiritual bypasser, spiritual bypasser. No, they've actually dropped out of Maya, out of the illusion, the mind-made illusion. And in that situation, there's no spiritual bypassing. They are using, I would say, consciousness in a very nuanced and appropriate way. Does that make sense? Am I getting that point across?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Yes. Yeah. 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 I have nothing more to say.
No, you don't need to.
I really hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Go on. Carry on.
I think it's coming from, you know, the person who's accusing the other person of it. I don't think that's probably coming from somebody who has a deep experience themselves of that letting go of being in touch with one's more authentic self. They probably don't have that themselves. And so they see the person who does, maybe they see that as some sort of threat because they're tasting something that they don't have. And so they're not doing the work that the other person is doing. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. It makes total sense. And at some point, I would love to go deeper into this, not today, but this issue of spiritual bypassing versus legitimate spiritual seeing and dropping of illusion, this leads into the next conversation, which is around boundaries. So sometimes, very much in the therapeutic world, people will say, well, you've got to assert your boundaries and you've got to impose this and you've got to name that. And just another way to to basically bully other people with that egoic entrenchment, my way or the highway. I believe this and my thought says that and this is appropriate. And ouch. So it leads, spiritual bypassing conversations lead into appropriate boundaries and setting of one's boundaries and what is actually kind versus not kind. So that concludes episode 2, my ongoing exploration and conversation with Pete Russell. Next week, I'm happy to report we get into some very juicy conversation, mostly around how we get stuck in our stories and also the need to be liked. What's that about? See you next week. You've been listening to Awaken with Angus Ford Robertson. To join my Awaken program, please visit angusfordrobertson.com.